previous installment of the story of Rabbor Chapatlan was concluded with the fact that Rabbor Chapatlan told his daughter Rochel about their illustrious ancestry going back to the Maharal of Prague and further even to David HaMelech. And Rochel in turn related this to Rabbor's sister Dvora Leah, the family tradition about the Maharal of Prague. And this is what she said. When the Maharal was only 7 years of age, he was already so brilliant and learned that he used to have discussions on Torah matters with the great scholars. He used to visit his father, Rabbi Bezalel, and his grandfather, Rabbi Chaim. The material position of Rabbi Bezalel was a very poor one. That is why he was anxious to get his four sons married as soon as possible. There was the Maharal, Chaim, Pini, and Shimshon. Rabbi Bezalel looked for respectable and well-placed people who would be able and willing to accept the responsibility of taking on his sons at an early age, supporting them while they studied at the yeshiva, and also even after their marriages, so that they could continue with their Torah studies without the financial worry of household expenses. When the Maharal was 10 years old, his father arranged that he become engaged to the daughter of the wealthy scholar Shmuel, the son of Rabbi Yankov Reich of Prague. He was so influential, was this Shmuel, that he had contacts with the royal family, and through his mediation, many Jews were helped. At this time, the yeshiva in Premishle, with the Gaon Rabbi Yankov Polak at the head, was very famous. Rabbi Yankov Polak was a disciple and a follower of Rabbi Yankov Margolis of Nuremberg. Rabbi Yankov Polak had his own way of studying. He had perfected the art of pilpul. He would divide each chapter of the halacha of the Jewish law into separate subjects. Each subject he would analyze into various opinions, and each opinion he would explain to the minutest point until it attained the peak of perfection. His yeshiva was therefore greatly sought after, but the Gaon was most careful in his acceptance of students. Only the most brilliant could hope to be admitted, and only 1 in 20 or 1 in 25 applicants succeeded in being accepted by him. And it was to this yeshiva that the young Maharal, at the early age of 12, was sent and was accepted. He remained there for 4 years, during which time he applied himself assiduously to his studies. Tradition has it that Rabbi Yankov said of his young pupil that he was the third point of the segel, which he had with God's help given to the Jews. Of all the thousands of students that went through his yeshiva, he proudly singled out these three: Rabbi Meir Katzen Ellenbogen, the Maharal of Padua, Rabbi Sholem Shachne of Lublin, and the Maharal of Prague. The Maharal used to say of his teacher that the yeshiva in Premishle, he not only taught his students how to follow the path of the finest thinking, but also to create complete and intricate structures of ideas. In the year 5282, about 1522, Rabbi Yankov left Premishle, became Rav of Prague. The young Maharal then decided to wander off into exile. 2 years passed in this way until he returned to Prague. At that time, Rabbi Yankov made a trip to Lublin to examine the yeshiva carried on by his former pupil, Rabbi Sholem Shachne. He was quite an old man at the time, and while he was in Lublin, he took ill and passed away. Shmuel Reich then wanted the Maharal to get married to his daughter, who you'll remember he was engaged to, and he could still continue his studies at the yeshiva even after the wedding. But Pearl, the fiancée of the Maharal, was only 14 years old at the time, and he thought she was too young for marriage. He asked that they give him leave to go to a yeshiva and study for another 4 to 5 years. Pearl was a brilliant young lady. When she was only a child of six and became a fiancée to the young Maharal, she realized his great genius and decided to study assiduously so that he should never be ashamed of her. She then began to study in secret right up to the time that her fiancé came back from the yeshiva. When they began to discuss certain matters from the Torah, the Maharal was amazed and delighted to find what a scholar she was. And before he left for a further 4 to 5 years of study at another yeshiva, he prepared a syllabus for her, and she promised to study as he had recommended to her. During his 2 years of exile, the Maharal had met some great and famous scholars, and while withholding his own name, he listened very closely to all he heard from them and wrote everything down. During this time, he happened to hear of a Gaon named Rabbi Yitzchak Klover of Vermes, who was then in Poznan, and that he had a most original way of Torah study, following along the lines of the great scholars of Germany and France. The Maharal decided that that was where he would spend his next few years of study. On reaching Poznan, he became acquainted with the grandson of Rabbi Yitzchak, Shlomo, the son of Yechiel Luria of Brisk, who was then about 17 years old. Although the Maharal was a couple of years younger, they both studied together under Rabbi Yitzchak and became firm friends. The old Rabbi Yitzchak later said of these two pupils of his that he had learned more from them than from his own teachers. The Maharal was so happy in his studies here that even at the end of the 4-year period, he was reluctant to leave, and wrote, asking permission from his fiancée and her father, that they allow him to continue there for a further 3 years. This permission was granted him, so he gladly remained. During the 3 years that the Maharal remained in Poznan, his future father-in-law, Shmuel Reich, became poor, and had to sell everything he possessed in order to pay his debts. He therefore wrote a letter to the Maharal explaining his changed circumstances and releasing him from his engagement to his daughter, as he was now in no position to carry out his obligations toward them. He told him that he was free to choose someone else as his wife under these circumstances. The Maharal immediately sent a reply to Pearl's father, expressing his sympathy at their changed circumstances, but saying that as far as he was concerned, it made no difference in his intention to marry Pearl, unless perhaps she herself did not wish to wait for him. When the Gaon Rabbi Yitzchak Klover later passed away, the Maharal, his friend Shlomo Luria, and other students all decided to leave Poznan and go to Krakow, which at that time was a famous center of Torah. The Maharal stayed in Krakow for 5 years, 3 of which he spent and studied together with his friend Shlomo Luria, or as he was known, the Marshal. The remaining 2 years he studied together with Moshe, the son of Rabbi Yisrael Israelis, later known as the Ramo. As the Maharal later related, he had never seen such a city as Krakow, where Torah scholars were held in the highest respect and esteem. Butchers, water carriers, and woodchoppers were all among the great scholars of the town, and the attitude in general between man and man was a most exceptional one. The town was an example of the highest in education and moral values. Torah and also its esoteric interpretations were studied there. In the very center of the town, there was a circular piece of ground measuring about 30 cubits, encircled by a brick wall. The story was told that at this particular spot, the earth once opened, swallowing up those who stood there before the eyes of a large crowd. And here is the story. In the year 1363, the Gaon Rabbi Yitzchak was nominated as Rav of Krakow. He had come from Germany, having been exiled with all other Jews during the expulsion from that country at that time. Krakow was then under the ownership of one of the Polish princes, and his estates were managed by a certain German Jew named Shlomo Zeligman. This Shlomo was a Kohen, but so far removed from religious thought that this meant absolutely nothing to him, and he was a sinner in every sense of the word. He had changed his name to Sigmund and had fallen in love with a divorcee in Krakow. She was a Jewess, and so he wanted to have the Rav marry them to please her family. He therefore approached Rabbi Yitzchak, who, when he learned that Seligman was a Kohen, naturally refused to perform the marriage ceremony, as it's forbidden by Jewish law for a member of the priestly tribe of Kohanim to marry a divorced woman. Seligman then retorted that he would willingly dispense with the privilege of his priesthood and only wished to marry the woman he had chosen to be his wife. And if the Rav refused to comply with his request to marry them according to Jewish law and custom, why then they would go off and get married in some other town, he threatened. The Rav then had this woman and her relatives call to him. They were wealthy and influential people, but this did not deter him from telling them that if this woman insisted on marrying Seligman, despite the Jewish law forbidding it, he would have her excommunicated. The relatives were business associates of Seligman and anxious to have him become a member of their family. So they turned a deaf ear to the Rav, thinking he was probably taking too strict a view of the law. Seligman, seeing that they were ready to support him in his wishes, flew into a rage at the Rav, especially when the Rav announced from the pulpit of the synagogue that he was issuing a strict warning to the would-be offenders that they dare not marry each other. The town was divided in its opinions in the matter. The scholars and other God-fearing Jews naturally upheld the view of the Rav. But the divorcees, rich relatives, and others who were also looking for loopholes in the law supported Seligman with an eye on future business dealings with him, perhaps. Seligman was a favorite with his employer, the Polish prince, and when he told him about his trouble and that because of a mere trifle the rabbi refused to marry him to the lady of his choice, the prince promised he would fix things for him so that everything would turn out fine. The prince then sent for the Rav and also asked the bishop to be there at the same time. The Rav, being then quite an old man, arrived accompanied by a senior member of the congregation. The prince then demanded to know the reason why the Rav refused to allow two people who so much wished to marry each other to do so. Rabbi Yitzchak explained that according to Jewish law, a member of the priestly tribe to which Seligman belonged was not allowed to marry a woman who had been divorced. And added the Rav, this was not a matter about which he had the power to decree otherwise. The prince then turned to the bishop and said that as he knew the Jewish Bible, could he say that there was any foundation for what the Bible contended? The bishop, being an anti-Semite and seeing his chance to do the Jews harm, smugly replied, there is such a law in the Bible, but the rabbis have the power to reverse the formula they so wish. Thus, they often forbid what has been said to be allowed and allow what the Bible says is forbidden. That is what the sages of the Talmud used to do, he added, wishing to show his extensive knowledge. The Rav then boldly asserted that what the bishop had just said was entirely untrue. When God gave the Torah to Moses, the Rav explained, everything was in writing. But in addition to this, he also gave him the oral Torah, which comprised explanation and interpretations of the Torah. These were handed down from generation to generation by word of mouth until the 32nd generation, the time of the sages who finally wrote them down. In this manner, the law has come down to us in all its clarity right from the time it was first given to the Jews at Mount Sinai. The bishop then began in a contemptuous tone to ask the Rav all sorts of irrelevant questions, thinking that he would thereby make him look silly in the eyes of the prince. But the Rav was not so easily disconcerted. He had expected some trick and was quite prepared with his answers. He was not the first person in Jewish history who had been thus attacked by Jew baiters. The Rav was acquainted with the discussions that the Ramban had had with the Christian leaders when he had similar questions put to him. Now the Rav answered all the questions, and this unlooked for turn of events threw the bishop into a rage, and fearing that the prince's admiration might extend towards all his fellow Jews, the bishop began wildly to deride the Jews and their faith. The Rav, though inwardly burning with indignation at the audacity of the bishop, remained outwardly quite calm, as he quietly reminded the bishop he should really speak with greater respect both about the Jews and their faith. Was he not aware of the saying known throughout the world, do not spit in the well from which you drink? Not only had the Christians drawn from the Jewish well, but even the one who had given the Christians their religion also emanated from Jews, whether in a natural manner as Jews believed or in a supernatural manner as the Christians believed. Bishop could restrain himself no longer and jumped up, shouting, "Unbeliever that you are! How dare you desecrate my God before my very eyes? And who then was your Moses?" "Moses, our teacher, was born like all humans," replied the Rav evenly. "He had a father, Amram, and a mother, Yocheved. He was born on the seventh day of Adar in the year 2368 after creation. He lived for 120 years and died in the seventh of Adar, his birthday, which was 2488 after creation." "I must say, you certainly seem to know when Moses was born and when he died," scoffed the bishop. "Certainly I know it," replied Rabbi Yitzchok, "and so does every other Jew, just as he knows that there is one God, for he has been told it clearly from generation to generation, from the time of our patriarch Abraham, who was the first to acknowledge the existence of one God." "And what about the God of the Christians?" asked the bishop. "There is only one God, none other," replied the Rav. "He is everyone's God," explained Rabbi Yitzchok, and began quoting from Christian sources in support of this statement, especially from the New Testament. The bishop saw that he had lost the battle. The Rav was obviously better versed in the bishop's Bible than the bishop himself. The prince here intervened. He knew well enough that the Rav had obtained the upper hand of the argument. But though the bishop was quite clearly beaten, the prince felt it his duty to give him his moral support. The prince therefore now interrupted the discussion by bringing back the matter of Seligman's marriage to the divorcee. So in a very high-handed tone indeed, he turned to the Rav and said, "Even if it be true that he's Jewish law is as you say it is, that it's forbidden for a Kohen to marry a divorcee, yet a Seligman is ready and willing to give up his privilege of being a Kohen and wishes to marry this lady, I command you to carry out his request and that you marry them according to Jewish law in the way that Seligman and his fiancée desire." The old Rav of Krakow, the saintly Rabbi Yitzchok, was not in the least bit intimidated by the prince's order, and replied calmly but firmly, "I would carry out your order with pleasure, were it not for the fact that I am obliged to follow the orders of a higher authority than yours, namely the Lord of creation. The Torah clearly forbids a Kohen to marry a divorced woman, so I will never perform the ceremony for Seligman." This threw the prince into a fury. "We shall soon see who will win in this instant," he retorted angrily. A few days later, the Rav was suddenly confronted with an armed band of soldiers who told him that they had been sent by the prince to bring Rabbi Yitzchok to the marketplace in the center of the town. The order further stated that there, before a large assembly of people, non-Jews as well as Jews, the Rav would be obliged to perform the wedding ceremony uniting Seligman with the divorcee. When the Rav arrived with his armed guard at the marketplace, Seligman and his bride were already waiting there for him. Also, the bride's relatives and a huge audience, all eager to watch this unusual wedding. For it was known by all that it was the prince's command which was responsible for the forthcoming wedding being enacted so spectacularly in the marketplace. The bride and groom were beaming. Their eyes gleamed with satisfaction as they saw the old Rav. Now he could see who had won this battle of wits. "But what was this?" the old man was saying. "I warn you," he said, "that I will not commit this sin forbidden by the Torah, even at the peril of my life," he said to the bride and groom, and there could be no doubt that he meant every word he said. "You should know that whatever will now follow, and what may befall others and myself, will all be the result of your sin." The old Rav continued to plead with them that they should even now reconsider this wicked idea that they planned to do, and if they would agree to give up their idea to marry each other, which was definitely against Jewish law, then the prince would withdraw his orders and the matter would be settled. "Have pity on yourselves," Rabbi Yitzchok begged with tears in his eyes. "Please do as I ask, not for my sake, but for your own." The bridal party not only turned a deaf ear to his pleading, but began to hurl insults at the old Rav for daring to ask them to change their plans. The Rav tried but once again to make them see how wrong they were, but it was all to no avail. The Rav Rabbi Yitzchok then raised his voice and called out with his eyes turned heavenward, "O Master of the universe, these people are trying to force me to sin against your commands. For your name's sake, dear God, and so that your faithful servants who keep your name sacred and pure faith be encouraged, look down from your holy heights and bless those who keep your commandments and curse those who stubbornly oppose you." Having said his prayer, The old rough turned yet again to the groom and the rest of the bridal party and begged them once again to repent and relent. But all he received by way of reply was a torrent of insults and curses. Rabbi Yitzchok then murmured another prayer, then called out in a loud voice, in a voice full of weeping, "Answer me, O God, answer me. Do this for the sake of your holy, great, and awe-inspiring name." The Rav had barely finished his soulful prayer when the earth began to tremble beneath them and open at their very feet. Before anyone could move to do anything, the bride and groom were sucked in by the earth up to their necks, and another moment, before the eyes of the whole multitude, they were swallowed completely out of sight. Everyone trembled in fear, then with relief saw the earth close up again, as if nothing had taken place to disturb it. The armed soldiers thrust their swords into the earth at the place where the couple had disappeared, to mark the spot where the tragedy had occurred. The news quickly spread through the town, and the place was in an uproar as everybody, man, woman, and child, all hurried to the marketplace to see the scene of the catastrophe. The news also came to the ears of the prince, and he realized how great was the saintliness and powers of the old Rav of Krakow. The prince then sent for the bishop to ask his advice as to how he could beg the pardon of the old rabbi, whom he and the bishop had treated with such contempt. The prince was now terrified lest he too should be punished for the part that he had played in the Seligman affair. When the prince's messenger reached the home of the bishop, he found the latter in a state of raving lunacy. He was throwing himself wildly about, and two priests were struggling in their efforts to restrain him by his arms and keep him still. The bishop was thrown into this state as soon as word reached him that the couple, Seligman and his bride, had been swallowed up by the earth when the old Rav had prayed to God. When the prince's messenger returned with a report about the bishop, the prince decided to go himself to Rabbi Yitzchok and ask him for forgiveness for insulting him and for treating his religion so lightly. The old Rav replied that there was no need for the prince to ask for forgiveness from him, for he had done nothing hurtful to him. And as for the way he had spoken about the Jewish religion, why, it was not his fault, but the fault of his wrong upbringing. The rabbi said that he had but one request to make of the prince, which was that as it was forbidden for Kohanim to go where there were any graves, would he have a brick wall erected around the spot where the couple had been swallowed by the earth in the center of the marketplace. The prince, somewhat subdued, agreed to have this done immediately. And exactly as the people had stood around the spot, so was a high circular brick wall erected there. The continuing story with the Maharal, as related by Rochel, the daughter of Baruch Batlin, to her daughter, Dvoreleia, God willing, in the coming installments.